Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My favorite thing about St. Bridget is that she's the patron saint of brewers.
Oh, I did not know this.
Yeah, one of St. Bridget's apparent miracles that garnered her sainthood was that she used to convert her used bathwater into beer for her guests at her monastery in Kildare. So she's seen as the patron saint of brewers. And it also means that anyone who is doing Dry January can finish Dry January on the patron saint of brewing.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's episode of the Group Chat Podcast. Just two of us in studio this week. I'm news correspondent Zara King, joined by political correspondent Gavin Riley.
We don't make much of a group, really.
No.
Just as a duo.
It's actually not a group chat at all, really, is it?
We should have asked Kilmacud Crokes if they had anyone spare. Topical news gag.
Well, we do have people joining the group chat this week,
because
otherwise it is really just
we should explain. Richard's on his holliers.
Richard
has an awful lot of overtime worked up, so
yes,
Richard's taking a bit of a breather.
And he's booked it since ages ago, and he was very much looking forward to this. He wasn't that sad leaving us at all.
No,
actually.
I'm sure he wouldn't.
He
who
kind
would
of
be?
Ran out the door.
Who would be sad leaving us, to be fair?
Yes, indeed. We have a lot to get through this week.
We do.
Some really interesting guests joining the group chat. We have delved into the newsroom to ask a colleague to join us this week on the group chat. And that is Nicole Gernon, who is joining us from the courts. Hello, Nicole.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you? So, Nicole, you have been covering for several weeks, if not months now, the Enoch Burke case, and he has turned up at the school again today. He's racking up bills of over €3,000 at this stage. Give us a bit of an update on where we're at now.
Oh, well, Zara, I suppose to give you an update on where we are now, we have to kind of go back to where it all began. So I'll take you back all the way to the end of the last school year in May, when the principal of Wilson's Hospital School, Niamh McShane, she was the principal at the time, and she issued a request that all teachers use a student's preferred pronouns of they and them and use a new name for that student. Now, Enoch Burke indicated that he wouldn't use this student's preferred pronouns, even though he didn't actually teach the student. And he then confronted the principal about this at a school service and a school dinner, and it's for this confrontation that he was then placed on paid administrative leave. Now, when the school then went on its summer holidays, and when it came back after its summer holidays, he showed up at the school even though he was on leave, and then that led to the school going to court to seek an injunction to try to prevent him from showing up at the school. They were then granted that injunction, but he then continued to show up at the school. So then the school went back to court, indicated that he was still showing up at the school. So that meant that he was then in contempt of court. So all he had to do to purge this contempt of court was to give an undertaking that he would not show up at the school. However, he refused to give this undertaking, and then he also indicated that he would continue to show up at the school. So that's what then landed him in jail. For actually just being in contempt of court. That's why he was jailed, and that's why he spent 108 days in jail. But then just before Christmas, a judge decided that he should be released, as he was exploiting his imprisonment for his own ends, and it was also costing the taxpayer too much money, and it didn't look like there was any probability of him actually purging his contempt. So he did warn him that if he did show up at the school again, he could be thrown back in prison. And lo and behold, after the Christmas holidays, Enoch Burke went back to the school. That led to the school going back to court again and to try to seek another measure to try to make him stay away. So it initially sought the sequestration or the temporary seizure of his assets, but a judge decided that perhaps fining him would be a more appropriate measure. Now, in the middle of all of this, he was actually dismissed properly as well from school after a disciplinary hearing. And then he did continue to show up at school. The €700 fine that has been imposed for every single day that he refuses to give an undertaking to stay away from school, that kicked in last Friday. And since then, he has been showing up at school. So, as you say, racking up quite a substantial bill at this stage.
And all of that made so complicated, Nicole, and good job on explaining it thus far anyway, but that along the way in the proceedings that led up to him being dismissed from the school, Enoch Burke was taking action against the school, while at the same time the school was taking action against him.
Yes, that's right, Gavin. So that's another element to it. So Enoch Burke sought several ways to try to actually overturn the injunctions that were issued by the High Court. The High Court pointed out to him that the only way doing this was to file an appeal. So he has filed an appeal to the Court of Appeal. That's going to be heard in 2 weeks' time, and that's an appeal against those injunctions. But at the same time, the full trial of the action, as it's called, about this whole dispute, that is due to be heard before Easter, when the school will be able to set out all of its case, and also Enoch Burke will be able to set out his case against the dismissal.
And Nicole, you've been at the school gates for a couple of the days now. I mean, what is the atmosphere actually like down there? Is it quite hostile? Is it quite tense? Do you speak to Enoch Burke? Does he talk to the media? What's it like down there?
Well, generally, Zara, he comes in, you know, about 8:45 or so. He generally doesn't talk on the way into school. He is being dropped off and collected by his dad at the moment, though. We have seen him driving in the past. I know some people have had questions about whether he can drive or not. We have seen him driving in the past, but at the moment, his dad is dropping him in and collecting him from the school. Some days on the way out, he does talk. We do ask him questions, but he doesn't really answer the questions. He usually tends to have what seems like a pretty pre-prepared speech, and then he just regurgitates that. At the moment, he doesn't really answer any questions from any of the reporters there. In terms of the students, I mean, it's difficult to say how it's affecting them. It must be affecting an awful lot of them. They tend to just go about their business. They go in and they come out. They don't stop or talk to us, and neither do their parents as well. And you can obviously understand that. You know, it is a very unusual situation that they are having to deal with at the moment.
It is very unusual, Nicole, and perhaps even unprecedented, maybe you might know better than us, that the idea that somebody who's in breach of a civil action would actually be facing fines like this on a daily basis, like Enoch Burke currently is.
Yeah, it is very unusual. Like, we have seen in the past that companies have been fined for breaching injunctions, but not so much individuals. And if that sequestration or temporary seizure of his assets had gone ahead, that would have been extremely unusual. That would have, in fact, been the first of its kind. So this is very unusual. As I say, the whole thing is due to be reviewed now next week on the 10th of February, because Mr. Justice Brian O'Moore, who issued this order that he could be fined, he said that if he doesn't have the desired effect, that he would be minded to review it, and it could always be increased if it wasn't having the desired effect. So it remains to be seen what he does do when he reviews it now next week, because it's difficult to really see, you know, on his teacher's salary how he can afford to pay it. Indeed, Enoch Burke last week indicated that anyone in his position wouldn't really be able to afford to pay it. So the court didn't really want to re-imprison him again for various reasons that it previously set out, and as I mentioned earlier on. But if he can't pay it, and if he keeps on showing up at the school, it may be just the case that the court may have to look again at re-imprisonment of a measure of making him stay away from the school, and as a sort of, I suppose, punishment for the fine, before this whole trial of the action is heard. And of course, then the outcome of that may be very different. We'll just have to wait and see what the outcome of that is.
Well, Nicole, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. You'll have to have you in studio the next time, but thank you so much for joining the group chat this week.
Thanks, guys.
Well, thank you so much, Nicole, for joining us. Lovely to have Nicole on the podcast this week. Some of the issues raised by the Enoch Burke case have been discussed in recent months, and we wanted to flesh that conversation out a bit more here on the group chat. And we are joined in studio now for that by Matt Kennedy, who is Research and Policy Officer with Belong To. Matt, we want to talk a little bit about the lived experiences of trans young people, trans people in school, at a school level. I know you had conducted some research in the last couple of months, which found that 76% say they feel unsafe.
Absolutely. So that was a piece of research that we conducted with Columbia University, and it was a repeat of initial piece of research that we did in 2019 that was looking at LGBT students' experiences of school with a specific focus around their well-being, their mental health, and how it relates to experiences of bullying and inclusion in schools. So naturally, unfortunately, it was a very stark picture for the vast majority of the LGBT students, but we have additional research that shows that trans students are additionally more vulnerable within the context of their lived experiences. So some of the findings that emerged around that, specific to kind of transphobic language that were being used in schools, was students were, like, 53% of them were hearing transphobic language from their peers. 36% were hearing that from school staff members as well. So they're really, that can really impact a student's sense of their belonging in a school environment if they're listening to transphobic language and they're not seeing themselves reflected potentially in school curricula, in policies or in procedures as well. So it can be quite challenging for a young person to feel as though they can come out if the school environment isn't cognizant of their needs or is potentially hostile to them.
You mentioned that there had been another study that was a repeat of. Mm. Did the picture get any better or worse, or was it about the same in the previous one?
No, so it was very consistent in terms of the findings. There was some improvements in different areas. The main kind of improvement for us that we think is very significant is that 99% of LGBT young people could identify one supportive staff member, and over half could identify 10 or more staff members that they felt were inclusive or fostering a sense of belonging among them. And we know from that research that if a student can identify at least one supportive staff member, they're more likely to be able to come to them, to be able to come out, to be able to speak about their potential needs. And that begins the conversation around fostering an environment where they feel as though they belong, they're accepted, and actually is more beneficial to their academic aspirations. And they're less likely actually to miss school as a result of that.
As a result of that. Mm. Now, you came out in the last 5 or 6 years, is that right? Tell us a bit about your own experience.
Yeah, so I came out when I was 19. And so I've a different experience to a lot of the trans young people who are in school at the moment. Because I suppose I went to school in an all-girls Catholic school in West Cork, where, as you can imagine, there was a lot of gendered elements around that experience, which was particularly challenging for me at the time, mostly because I didn't have a language to describe what it meant to be trans that could kind of account for my sense of my gender. So what's a really significant part of our work in Belong To is to move to ensuring that, you know, LGBT identities and experience broadly, but with a specific focus on trans identities and experiences, are included in the curriculum. They are part of the fabric of the educational environment for young people, so they see themselves reflected, they have access to a language to be able to communicate who they are. Like for me, if I think about being back, because I would have had an awareness of that discomfort from very, very young, like about as young as 8. And then if I think about if I was in secondary school and someone had just introduced what it meant to have a different gender expression and identity, then I feel like I would have saved myself an awful lot of time
you'd have been ahead of the process.
Yeah.
If there was somebody in your life basically who was able to sort of give you the vocabulary that you needed to express what you were going through, you might have been more likely to say it out loud a lot earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. And not even so much even just the vocabulary, but someone to kind of affirm that being trans is not only, you know, a reasonable thing to be in society, but actually something that is valued and is accepted and is meaningful in the diversity of Irish society. I think definitely in my experience growing up, that was absent from my lived experience. And it's really meaningful for me to work with and to support trans young people who they have people, particularly educators in their life, who value the diversity that their gender identity brings to a school environment.
And you mentioned that you were 8 when you kind of first realised that maybe, you know, there was something different. And I suppose when you talk about being in a girls' school, that must have been kind of distressing probably on some levels, because you probably felt like I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time or something. You know, even as you mentioned there, I went to a Catholic girls' school. Mm. I know, you know, a lot of people listening there's a lot of things that are very specifically female in that environment that must have felt really at odds with who you are on the inside, you know?
Yeah, certainly. And I mean, there are definitely synchronicities between my experience now, even though it's a couple of years on, with trans young people who are experiencing that right now. Mm. I'm thinking really along the lines of kind of things like uniforms, yeah, bathroom facilities, the ways in which sports are thought about, even the way the curriculum is kind of thought about as well, in terms of we tend to gender subjects maybe inadvertently as well. So a large part of our work is to encourage schools to not kind of think about things in that way, and that all students, irrespective of their gender identities, should be respected in the context of their needs, whether that's, you know, the uniform that they're going to feel more comfortable in. And that's not to say that the uniform gets thrown out entirely, but just if a student is going to feel more comfortable in a skirt or in a pants, they should feel empowered to ask for that, and they should be supported when they do.
I went to an Longpoys Catholic boarding school.
Oh, wow, okay.
So I can't imagine what that would have been like for anyone who might have been in my year, any other year, who was having some gender dysphoria. Is there any estimate, or is there any way to even estimate how many people out of the let's even take secondary school, for example. There must be about 400,000 odd students in second level in Ireland. Any way to estimate how many of them may be going through that kind of process?
Yeah, so it is difficult to have an estimate around numbers of the population that are LGBT. You can kind of, I suppose, from some research, say that potentially it's 1 in 10 people. But again, there's issues around reporting because of, you know, potential stigma and discrimination. People aren't maybe going to freely offer that information always. But we always would go to, you know, when talking to educators, when talking to the public as well, to make them aware, there's more than likely at least one LGBT student in a classroom.
When we were chatting on the phone yesterday, you and I were saying, you know, it's interesting, like, you know, sometimes when we see trans people depicted in media or depicted in like movies or TV shows, that often it's kind of their struggle and their challenges are documented, but often we don't get to see the positive aspects of life for them. And, you know, you talked yesterday about being accepted and affirmed and living a very happy and fulfilled life. You know, that is something that we don't often hear about in terms of the trans experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some of that is kind of paired alongside, it is quite challenging to be a trans person. You do often experience, you know, additional discrimination in a wide variety of contexts, not just educational, as we're talking about, but also, you know, being trans is one of the greatest joys in my life. It's a you know, the project of ensuring equality, rights and justice for trans people is something that I've dedicated my life to, and I would imagine I will continue to for the rest of my life. And I'm really lucky that I continue to meet people in different fields who also in some way are part of that project. And I'm endlessly grateful that part of my work means I get to meet young people who have an infinitely better experience than I've had, and that will continue for generations. So I do think that it's really important to highlight that, you know, being trans is also something that's really joyful, yeah, and really transformative.
Just going back to the school aspect and the survey findings that you mentioned a few minutes ago, one of the things that I kind of jolted when I heard you say it was that people had heard, or an X percentage had heard transphobic language from a teacher. Mm. I suppose it's one thing for people of younger generations maybe to sort of think that this is something they're not familiar with, it's not in their lives, and they use othering language. But to hear it from adults in positions of responsibility, that kind of strikes me as very unusual. And it makes me wonder how you go about creating a more inclusive environment among the staff.
Yeah, and I mean, that in the grand scheme of things, a lot of that work is kind of to foster a greater sense of education around what potentially transphobic language looks like. Because sometimes transphobic language might actually materialize in terms of like heavily gendered latent language as well, that is particularly unsettling for potentially a trans person in school. So it is kind of an educational piece around the entire student body, you know, peers and staff and educators alike, to say that, you know, language has a really meaningful impact on how we understand ourselves. And if there's language that is positioning, you know, your sense of yourself and your identity in a really disparaging light, it's going to kind of erode your sense of self, your mental health and your well-being.
Did you find, you know, when we talked about the coming out, because even it was interesting when we talked about it yesterday, because I think even in the 5 years or 6 years since you've come out, things have gotten a little bit easier. Mm. We are seeing things improving all the time, aren't we? But is there still kind of a lack of information, do you think, for maybe, as you say, like people's parents or older generations or even people our own age? You know, I mean, we're, you know, everyone is open to learning, but is the information there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there has definitely been a move in the past couple of years to ensure that there is a greater level of awareness and education around trans people's experiences, and specifically kind of coming from trans people ourselves, that we have a role in what that education looks like. And I think specifically for educators, like Belong To You has an e-learn that is free, that's available to all teachers and staff members engaged in post-primary education. We also have a Stand Up Awareness Week, which is our anti-homophobic, biphobic and transphobic bullying week. All of that has kind of educational elements embedded within it. And we have a really excellent education and training team that acts as that hub of support for teachers. They can kind of pick up the phone or send an email and come to us, and we can also do that kind of case by case support as that's coming up in a school environment.
Do you have much engagement with young people who are finding it difficult not alone to be trans in their school, but who may be beginning to question their own gender identity and are finding that their home, or that their parents or their guardians, their home life may not be the most supportive or understanding environment for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of research that shows that, you know, trans young people are more likely to experience social rejection, and that would include their families. And part of, I suppose, our role is to work with, you know, parents and guardians when a young person is coming out. In as much as we provide support for the young person, we are always a resource for parents or guardians. Even I know in the context of my own experience that I would have had a very challenging coming out experience with my family initially. And now a number of years on, I can see that they were really operating from a place of fear, similar to what we had spoken about. They're really worried about what my life would look like. You know, would I be safe? Would I be healthy? Would I have friends? Would I be able to get a job? All of these rational concerns, given the way that trans people have been depicted across society. So I think it's really important that there is that support for parents and guardians as well, in as much as that's kind of paired alongside support for the young person.
Which is worth stressing as well, because I know, and I don't mean to demean or sort of belittle the experience, but I know that there are so many parents who may, when a child comes to them and says, listen, I'm having questions about my gender identity, they might be inclined to write it off as something of a phase, or that they think that it's something that, you know, the kid is going through, they're confused, or they're just trying to find their place in the world, and it's something that they'll grow out of. And therefore, they kind of dismiss the child bringing it to them and don't really engage with it at any more meaningful level.
Yeah, and that's certainly part of it, I think. But some of the work that we do around that would be to say that, you know, we do afford like cisgender, non-trans and heterosexual young people the kind of self-knowledge around their genders and their sexualities. We understand that they know that for themselves. Our kind of role as, I suppose, providing a support and a service for those young people and their families is to say that provide them with the same sort of self-knowledge and agency that you'd give to other young people, and respect them in their capacity to know. Like at 8 years old, I, you know, fully turned around to my mom and was like, I'm a boy. You know, and, you know, I go to 20 odd years later, I am in fact a man. That I had somewhere, maybe I didn't have the language to articulate all of the nuance around that, but I was fairly certain in that awareness. And I think where some of that gets buried for people is that initial potentially bad reaction, and some of that might be a dismissal. So it's really to encourage people to, if they have concerns, to lean into them, to address them, but certainly bring it to us as a service provider. Don't necessarily have them out with your young person.
Well, I was going to say that. So there could be some parents listening to the podcast today who might have had that conversation with their child, you know, their 8-year-old, who might have said to them, look, mum or dad, you know, I feel like I'm in the wrong body. Like, or maybe they don't have the language for that, but they feel like, why would I wear a dress today when I feel like I'm a boy? You know, so what would you say to those parents? Is there any tangible kind of advice not to, maybe, as Gav said there, maybe not to dismiss that as just a phase, but to actually maybe have an open conversation and let them maybe, you know, role play or live out that sort of experience perhaps?
Yeah, and I can absolutely heed, you know, with the experience of this year's on, of what it must have been like for my parents kind of taking in that information for the first time. My advice really would be, irrespective of whether you feel totally able to support or this feels, you know, very unnerving for you, to just kind of assure the young person, like, that you're there for them, that you love them, you support them, and you want to be there with them for whatever this journey is, however it unfolds. And if you need additional support, to come to organizations like Belong To, because we are there both for the young person in your life, but also for you, as the adult who, you know, deeply cares and supports them. I really have had the benefit of that in my work, to see that every single adult, you know, that gets in contact with us is working from a place of good faith, and from a place of love and of care.
We changed the law in Ireland 8 years ago to allow self-identification as the basis to have a new gender recognised in law. And we've seen the debates happening across the water now, where Scotland have tried to follow suit and Westminster's getting in the way and saying no. And it starts to politicise the very existence of young trans people. How does it feel watching that debate happen on the other side of the sea, knowing that Ireland's taken that step and the world hasn't fallen in, that society is still functioning, and seeing there being so much fear and panic in some quarters about the same experience on the other side of the sea?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, as you know, a trans person living in Ireland, I have an awful lot of pride around our gender recognition legislation, considering that we operate on a principle of best practice globally, in that we utilise self-determination. We move to, in a legislative capacity, believe trans people when we say that this is my gender, and I deserve to be recognised as that in a legal capacity. Because really, it is very challenging to move through the world with the wrong identification. It's unbelievably challenging. Like, I had to negotiate what it meant to go to higher level education, get my transcripts, try and get funding for my PhD. There was lots of challenges that emerged from not having that. And then when I was able to, and the process was very straightforward, and like you said, said, the world didn't fall apart. I was able to be, you know, legally recognized in the context of my gender and was able to kind of progress, you know, really in a moment of affirmation for who I am. As a trans person and as a man. So I think that Ireland should hang on to that sense of pride. We should use the existing framework we have in that it functions really well. It benefits the trans community very well. And we haven't had issues emerge from the way that that legislative process works. And so we should really be seen as, you know, at the forefront of what it means to appropriately provide for trans people in that legislative context.
I think kind of to summarise what you're saying, or what we're taking away from it, is that, you know, what you're saying is if someone tells you who they are, believe them and respect that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have that functioning in law, and it functions really, really well. Yeah, and really benefits trans people's lives.
Matt Kennedy, thank you so much for coming in. Really
thank
enjoyed
you.
That conversation.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. That. Thanks.
Cheers.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit about artificial intelligence and some tools that some viewers or listeners might have used in the last couple of weeks called ChatGPT. Zara is one of those people who has not used ChatGPT.
No, I have not.
Do you know anything about this?
Well, we had a meeting, obviously, before the podcast.
But are you at all familiar with the technology or what it does?
I've never used it. I'm not familiar with it. You said you were going to show me.
Yeah,
I'm ready to be impressed.
I appreciate that for people who aren't watching on television, even those who are, this will not make for very stimulating watching for just a second. But ChatGPT, basically, once you've signed up to it, it's a website. It's got a little text box and you can type in any message that you like and ask it to respond for you. So I'm going to type in, what are some good ideas for a current affairs podcast? Let's see what it says to me. Here are some ideas for a current affairs podcast. 1. Political analysis. Discuss the latest political developments, elections and policies. 2. International relations. 3. Environmental issues. 4. Economic trends. Analyze the latest news and the trends, the impacts they have on business. Social justice. It could go on. Like, it's a very sophisticated answer for something that we've just asked it to do.
Do another one.
Going to write, now this is going to really go blow people's minds if
this
you haven't seen it before.
This is very niche now.
Write
very
a letter niche. To Santa. In the style of Michael D. Higgins. Enter. And it only takes a couple of seconds before the answers come up. And it like the how sophisticated this is going to blow your mind. Put it in, press enter for a couple of seconds. And here comes the letter. Dear Santa, greetings of peace and joy from the Republic of Ireland. But bear in mind, I did not say Michael D. Higgins was the President of Ireland. It's picked that up. I hope this letter finds you in good spirits and health, surrounded by the love and laughter of your elves. As we approach, this is a little slower than it almost usually is. As we approach the festive season, I cannot help but reflect upon the year that has passed and the challenges we have all faced. I'm fighting so
this
hard.
This is unbelievable. This is unbelievable.
That this is something like, you can almost hear it being said in his voice.
You turn your screen around.
It is important that we come together to support one another to show kindness and compassion.
Never mind.
You can't see it, but you can just see the text just appearing.
It's typing
spontaneously on the screen, just as I've done that. So this is a tool called ChatGPT. It is the latest in a very public-facing system of artificial intelligence tools. We're joined by Dr. Robert Ross from the Technological University of Dublin, who is a researcher into all this area. Robert, thank you for joining us this week on the group chat. Without asking too simple a question, how does this work?
Should keep the question simple. ChatGPT is a chatbot, a conversational bot. And, you know, we've had them since the 1960s. But this one is particularly interesting because it's good, and it's good in many different ways. And I think the core technology in itself isn't a breakthrough, but it is this idea of something called a large language model. Now, what that is a big scraping of huge amounts of information from the internet and encapsulating this in, you know, something that's called a neural network, a particular type of AI that we use commonly in different applications. And it's set up in such a way that if you give it a prompt, like a question, or give it some instruction, it's really, really good at synthesizing unique answers to those questions or prompts that you can just come up with. And because it's got such a huge amount of data that it's been trained on, and it's so big in terms of all its parameters, everything that it considers when it makes its answer, it really does come up with some genuinely interesting, creative answers to questions. And like I've seen cases of people asking for not just suggestions on topics, but, you know, write me a screenplay, write elements of a screenplay or a script or a presentation or a podcast that would meet some particular goals. So like the types of uses of this are huge. An awful lot can be very good. So for example, as an educator, as well as a researcher, I find the idea of students, be them kids in school all the way through to PhD students, just, you know, normal undergrads, having extra tutors, like this sort of virtual tutor that they can go and ask questions of, and when they get back the answer, being able to probe in a little bit deeper, I find that really exciting. I think that's a great thing. We've been trying to do that for years, and this has really opened the door there. And then in terms of other creative industries, your own in journalism, I've heard people mention the idea that it can be great to get an initial bit of text together that they can then start building upon. Mm-hmm. So in terms of positive uses, I think they're huge, absolutely huge. But with any new technology like this one, that's particularly what we might call a disruptive technology, in the sense that we don't totally know what direction it's going to go in. We don't totally know where it's going to go and how it's going to be used. There's always some danger in terms of the way it might be used. Either the simple case that everyone's been asking me and others about, of course, are issues like plagiarism and students. But I think, you know, particularly for a political venue, we also need to consider the idea of, you know, who are the custodians of this sort of information? And while the OpenAI ChatGPT is great, imagine a future where systems like this are controlled by organizations who mightn't always have good intentions at heart.
And Gavin's going to bring us the rest of that letter before the end of this segment. But just in terms of the accuracy and the information, I mean, you know, people perhaps, as you say, using it maybe to do college assignments or whatever, that, I mean, how accurate is the information in terms of fact checking what it throws up?
Broadly, in the broad sense, it's accurate in that it's sort of like being scraped from an awful lot of information, but it is definitely not foolproof and it makes mistakes. There's a very well-regarded American researcher, Andrew Ng, and I think his initial tweet reaction captures a lot of our views, which is that it can be great, but hilariously wrong at times. And you can by no means be sure it's got its facts straight. So whenever answers are produced by it, really you should be checking to make sure that those answers are correct. One of the colleagues I work with in the ADAPT Center, he has a great example he showed me of how he was asking about a local fishing organization when it was built, and ChatGPT gave him a lovely summary about the fishing organization that he was using in a letter. But it had the year of creation of the fishing club just totally wrong. And we still can't figure out where it even got that wrong date from. Now, if you talk back to it, and that's one of the nice things about ChatGPT, you can sort of like correct it in a conversational way and you say, actually, you know, the date was this. It will turn around and say, oh, right, okay, sorry, I now understand the date was whatever the corrected date was. But that still doesn't explain why I got the date wrong in the first place. So you have to be careful. And well, I think that's a key issue people need to keep in mind about these technologies.
Well, that idea that it can learn from its mistakes is one of the things which is in a way so exciting, but also maybe so daunting about it. Because if it's possible for this system to train itself to when it's learned things and when it finds out that it's got something wrong, it also then begs the question, can it learn to improve itself? And then does that mean we could be looking at a system where you have very elaborate systems of artificial intelligence that are capable of self-improvement? And that kind of opens a Pandora's box then for what the technology can actually achieve.
It does. And only recently, actually yesterday, I came across a couple of reports where people were mentioning that they had got ChatGPT to write the code for another chatbot, for another conversational AI. And that starts to raise those questions that you're mentioning about, can this thing start to improve itself in a very explicit way? For the moment, I would still say, well, no, it can't, because still there was some human sitting down and giving the controls and parameterizing what needed to be done for this better system. So like there is still a human in control. ChatGPT is just making it a little easier to perform the task. But you're dead right. I mean, in the long-term view, people have this great fear about AIs improving on their own intelligences. And it's not an area I pay a lot of attention to. It's more of a science fiction area in a way. But that whole question of the singularity is ultimately that goal when you've got an AI that can just improve on it so much it no longer needs us. But again, that's sort of going into the realm of AI. When you talk about it being modified, I think some of the more pressing short-term concerns are things I would have an issue with, such as misinformation. We know in Wikipedia, for example, a lot of effort had to go into moderation eventually in terms of making sure that the information being entered into it was valid and valuable information and without bias. So a big challenge, not immediately with ChatGPT, but with systems like it, is making sure that when corrections, when extra information are being added into customized systems, that they are high quality extra pieces of information and people with more nefarious interests aren't adding in information to achieve something that's more negative, particularly with respect to society. So that's a big area that we would find interesting in terms of how these systems are used, not just by the individual, but by politicians, society in general.
Yeah, I suppose the big concern really is that it's only as good as the information that's fed into it. And if there's a lot of wrongful information online, then it can reach the wrong conclusion out of that. I think one of the reasons why people find this to be so exciting or so fascinating is because almost to a degree, there is that science fiction aspect where if you can train this thing to start talking like a human, you can train it to start writing speeches like Michael D. Higgins, for example, then it sort of begs the question, then could you end up feeding it enough examples of literature or speech from a particular person, whether it's a politician or even just a loved one? If you had enough recordings of a loved one, could you ultimately then feed those into an AI system and then have this virtual replica of a real life person?
Yes, in terms of style, that is a big challenge, a big question. And I know that I've read different discussions on this, some people pointing out that, you know, a derived work is ultimately, you know, a derived work. It's not the original work. Therefore, you can derive and you don't need to worry about the originator of the content. But on the other hand, people are pointing to the idea of, you know, people own their own visual identity. And I remember first there was like this video of somebody had synthesized an actor long after they died, and it had raised a lot of questions about who owns that identity. And I think this is going to raise some new questions again about the ownership of particular styles, because there's one thing for a parody to be constructed. And of course, a parody is free of those concerns. But when somebody is genuinely taking some other author's style, say J.K. Rowling's, based on her Harry Potter books, etc., and her other writings, and suddenly coming up with a book that's in the style of J.K. Rowling, it does open up all of those questions about whether that's fair, whether that's overreach from the technology company's perspective. And I certainly know, or I believe that OpenAI and companies like them are being careful about this and trying to make sure they don't step on too many toes just yet to make sure they don't end up with a whole heap of legislative controls sitting on top of them.
And likewise, would you have concerns about things like deepfakes? I mean, we're not totally, you know, familiar with deepfakes. You might just go into a bit of detail about what a deepfake is and the role that this could play in that.
Well, a deepfake is, from an image perspective, it's quite similar. It's a type of what we call a generative AI application where you can take lots of training data of somebody, be it Barack Obama is one of the famous examples, and generate a new unique video that you set the text for, you say what he's going to say, and a video is produced that looks and sounds just like that individual. That's what a deep fake is. And they've been knocking around and improving in quality greatly over the last couple of years. And again, it introduces the challenge with many of these generative techniques that people can't tell the difference between what was original work and what was ultimately some sort of derived work. Maybe that derived work is there for good, which is great, but maybe it's there for other more dangerous reasons. And I think that's why we need people to be aware and always question, you know, what is the legitimacy of whatever content it is that they're looking at? And that could be music, movies, images, etc. But you can imagine how something like deepfakes could be used or are already used to pretend that politicians said something. And then ultimately, if you're seeing a document, a letter or something that really sounds like it's in the style of somebody, it would be pretty easy to hoodwink people into thinking, yeah, that was actually written by that person. And they really did say that when obviously they didn't.
Well, speaking of that.
Speaking of that, I want to read people the rest of Michael D's letter to Santi. As we reflect on the year that has passed, I'm reminded of the resilience and determination of our communities in the face of adversity. In these challenging times, it is more important than ever to cherish the simple moments of happiness and to bring light into the lives of those around us. I'd like to take this opportunity to extend my warmest wishes to you and your team of elves as you embark on your journey to deliver gifts and joy to children
everywhere.
What does
he ask Santa for, Gav?
I should ask actually what Michael D. Higgins would ask Santa for. That's a question for another time. Robert Ross from the Adapt Centre and the School of Computer Science and Technology, University of Dublin. Thank you so much for joining
us
week on the group chat. Thanks for joining
us.
Thank you to Dr. Robert Ross. I'm going to be honest, right? I do find it a little bit terrifying.
I understand why you
would. I do a little bit now. I think it's amazing.
I know that Robert described it as being the work of science fiction and that it's good not to sort of think too much about it. But if you are getting into a world where these systems are capable of self-improvement, it's not unthinkable that you only need one system to go rogue and decide, well, I'm not going to, it's in my interest as a system to not follow whatever prompts the human has given it to work out whatever I want to do.
We had a question from our director, Dan, in the gallery, who wants to know, what would Michael D. actually ask?
Because Michael D. wrote a letter to Santa, but didn't actually include a request for any gifts. So I asked ChatGPT, what would Michael D. Higgins ask Santa for? And the answer, long-winded as ChatGPT tends to be, as President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins is known for his commitment to social justice, equality and the promotion of human rights. He may have had a number of requests for Santa Claus that reflect these values, including one, a world in which everyone has access to basic needs like food, shelter, and medical care. Two, a greater understanding and acceptance of different cultures and perspectives. Three, an end to conflict and violence. Four, increased efforts to protect the environment and preserve our planet for future generations. It is important to note, ChatGPT adds, that these are just some examples of what President Higgins might request. They are not based on any specific statements made by him. Ultimately, the requests of any individual, including the President of Ireland, are a matter of personal preference and belief. So he might have asked for a train set.
Director Dan wants to know why there's no train set as a prize on that list. I mean, it's
fascinating.
So fascinating. And I find it very funny that you nearly went into your Michael D. voice when you were
so
reading
difficult.
The letter.
When it was loading so slowly.
I don't think the world's ready to hear your Michael D. voice yet. Do you want to
some Christmas episode, maybe, not today.
We'll keep it. Did you forget that we had a bank holiday? If anyone's listening, surprise if you didn't remember, there's a bank holiday this weekend. And the joy of realising that one forgot the new bank holiday.
It's a really good month of the year to have an extra bank holiday.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Isn't it?
Absolutely glorious.
Because that post-Christmas time where in January and it's all miserable and everyone still feels a little bit out of sorts or out of shape after Christmas. And then suddenly you've made it through January and you're like, wham, bam, another a Monday off. It's great.
Remind us, Gav, of how this bank holiday came about.
This was originally conceived of as something.
Do you remember the day you reported this? Do you remember the commotion around that new bank holiday? Oh my God, tell that story. Have you time to tell that story?
I better do now because I'd forgotten that I was the first person to report this.
Yes.
So this was floated as something during one of the phases of COVID where things
were a little bit lighter. You ended up reporting it way before then it actually got confirmed a few weeks later.
Yeah, it was one of those things where a stopped clock is right twice a day because I reported and then eventually it became true anyway. So it was being discussed in one of the COVID lulls where the restrictions were not quite as severe. It was discussed as something that we should do to commemorate those who died from COVID, but also to acknowledge the work of frontliners and the like, should there be either a one-off or a persistent recurring bank holiday.
Yeah.
And last year we had one. St. Patrick's Day last year fell on the Thursday. The Friday was also granted as an additional day off. So it was something of a day of remembrance for those who died during the COVID-19 pandemic, but also just a recognition of some of the work that many people had done throughout all of that. But from this year on, it's going to be on the first Monday of February, unless the 1st of February, St. Bridget's Day, which is the day today that we're recording this, unless that's a Friday, in which case it will actually fall on the Friday itself. Now, for what it's worth, I think Bank Holiday Fridays are a far better idea than Bank Holiday Mondays.
Oh,
I think they
God,
always
that's
feel
controversial
like,
now.
Is it though? I feel like people...
I need to decide what I prefer, Friday or Monday.
I think a bank holiday always, to me, feels spiritually like a Saturday. So I think it makes more sense to have the two Saturdays in spirit running together.
Because isn't the beauty of Bank Holiday Monday that you don't get the Glen Rose on a Sunday? You get him on the Monday, but Sinead agrees on the floor.
Yeah, Sinead on the floor. That's our test case. So that's what it is.
That's the point of the bank holidays. You don't get the Glen Rose on the Sunday.
I'd completely forgotten that I was the first person to report that.
I remember when it happened and you were like...
And I reported and I went to the news at 8. And then I remember literally turning my phone off airplane mode after the news at 8, as it then was, and getting a text from a minister who was at cabinet, which was still ongoing at that time, being like... I don't know where you got that from. And I went, Oh no, I remember the mild panic
when that
And the mild panic, and then everyone being like, hey, when's this new bank holiday coming? And because it took so long for the government to eventually decide that we should have one, it sort of felt like I was given a really, really bad steer by someone who is usually in the know on these things. Lo and behold,
but it did happen right in the end. It did happen.
And it's next Monday. And enjoy it, everyone. And just remember the first person who told you about it.
It was Gavin Morelli. It's the St. Bridget's bank holiday.
It is, which means that all four of the Celtic festivals are now bank holidays. So this is either St. Bridget's Day or Imbolc, which was the old Celtic festival to mark spring. So Imbolc, Bealtaine, Lunasa, and Samhain are the bank holidays now at the start of February, May, August. And the Halloween start of November bank holiday, which is a really nice kind of touch that like all four of the old Celtic festivals that the calendar used to be completely built around are now still holidays in the modern in the modern day.
I do love the kind of, I have to say, I do love seeing people sharing like the St. Bridget's Day celebrations online, and you know, even people who you wouldn't maybe necessarily describe themselves as being religious or anything, that they're sort of celebrating women, and it's a real, you know, celebration of femaleness.
Yeah, and even today, the day that we're recording this on Wednesday, Leo Varadkar had a little moment in the Dáil where he made a little speech to say, well, today is St. Bridget's Day and it's a holiday and it's a day in which we now celebrate the role of women in Irish society and the achievements that they've had, which if that does become what this bank holiday is,
it just becomes
an annual celebration, like a formalised nulling them on, but like on an official everyone gets a day off sense.
I kind of love that. My late grandmother always loved Bridget and always celebrated St. Bridget's Day. Actually, I remember when we were growing up, like Bridget, and she'd always have a Bridget's cross. Like she was really into Bridget and really into that sort of female empowerment aspect of it. Key question. A lot of people online sort of campaigning to have Bridget be bigger than St. Patrick. There's a bit of competition between the two days. What do you think?
It'd be kind of nice to have a national holiday that isn't one that we have to share with the rest of the world. Isn't it? Like if St. Bridget is one of our patrons of same standing to Patrick, it'd be kind of nice to have just a, you know,
one for ourselves.
House private, just before we have to celebrate the whole world, just kind of enjoy ourselves. My favourite thing about St. Bridget is that she's the patron saint of brewers.
One of
St. Bridget's apparent miracles that garnered her sainthood was that she used to convert her used bathwater into beer for her guests at her monastery in Kildare. So she's seen as the patron saint of brewers. And it also means that anyone who is doing Dry January can finish Dry January on the patron saint of brewing.
And that,
which I think is a really nice
listeners,
note.
Listeners, is what we call Gav doing Gav things.
Oh dear, we better finish.
We better finish. Thank you so much for listening this week. Before we let you go, just a reminder maybe to leave a little review, a
rating or a subscribe or a thumbs up or whatever it is on whatever platform it is. Leave a little rating. It's really good to help us.
And if you write a little review, we might read out some of the nice reviews next week.
Only the nice ones.
I love how I'm committing to doing this and I'll forget to do it. No, I won't forget it. We'll read them out. We're going to read them out next week. We will be back next week. Richard will still be on his holidays. So we'll get some new, interesting, exciting people. If you have any suggestions of people you'd like to see joining the group chat, you can contact us across all our social media platforms.
Indeed.
But for now, we bid you good night, good afternoon, and good morning whenever you're listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.